librarians were out in force this weekend at Comic-Con. It's the largest pop culture convention in the country. This year, there were panels on the new animated Star Wars movie and the TV shows Lost and Battlestar Galactica. So what are librarians doing at Comic-Con? Beth Accomando from member station KPBS reports they were looking for manga, Japanese comic books, to fill their shelves.
I'm here at the San Diego Comic-Con on the last day of the convention, and I'm here with librarian Eva Volin, and we're looking for manga on the floor. Eva, what have you seen so far here that you want to talk about?
Right now we're with the Dark Horse booth, and I'd love to take a look and see if they have copies of Bride of the Water God. Oh, and they also have Translucent on the shelf, which is great. I love this series, particularly for middle school and younger high school students.
At 40, Eva Volin is one of a new breed of librarian. One that grew up loving comic books. So when it came to putting American comics and Japanese manga on the library shelves, she said it was a no-brainer. Fellow librarian David Cerche agrees.
We were the kind who were comic fans and then became librarians. There are others who were librarians who now are finally becoming comic fans because of the influx into it.
Cerche, who's from Florida, got money from the Broward County Friends of the Library to come to Comic-Con. And there's one very simple reason why libraries are paying attention to Japanese manga.
Well, it's been shown over the years that people do, especially teens and even younger, will read graphic novels and manga. Our circulation stats for that area are through the roof.
If you want proof, just visit any library and look at the manga section. The shelves are likely to be almost empty because up to 90% of the titles have been checked out. Libraries can hook young readers with a manga series like Fruits Basket, which concerns a recently orphaned girl who moves in with a classmate and his cousin, who just happen to be possessed by animal spirits. It has more than a dozen volumes, so kids come back to the library because they want to keep following the story. Fruits Basket is what's known as shoujo, or manga aimed at girls. Eva Volin says manga attracts young women in a way that American comics can't seem to do.
I'm a typical girl reader, which means that I'm very attracted to character development, and I'm more about story than I am about action as a reader, and a lot of manga typically focuses on character development and growth, along with the action and the humor that you want to find in a book.
Eva Volin looks back to the American Library Conference in 2002, with its panels on comics, graphic novels, and manga, as the moment when libraries started to take note of manga. Since then, libraries have been working to meet the needs and interests of a new generation of readers, and those younger readers are showing an appreciation. Eva Volin recalls an encounter with a young girl who was at the library trying to check out some manga with her mother.
And, you know, being the helpful reference librarian that I was, I said, oh, you're really going to like that story. I enjoyed it very much. And the girl did a double take and turned to her mother and said, see, Mom, even old people read these.
For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
People inherit many things from their parents, money, looks, property, history. And that last thing, history, can be a blessing and a burden if you come from a long line of rabble-rousing political activists. Cheryl Cashin, an author and law professor, writes about race relations in America. This time, she puts the microscope to her own family for her book, The Agitator's Daughter. The agitator of the title is Cashin's father, Dr. John L. Cashin, a dentist in Huntsville, Alabama, who challenged the segregationist Dixiecrats by founding an independent party for black Democrats. Cheryl Cashin's family faced constant threats. After one protest, Cashin landed in jail with her parents. She was 4 months old. Cashin says she wanted to understand why her father risks everything by pouring his passion and most of the family's money into the cause.
My father attracted enemies. There's no question in my mind. I can't prove it, but so many things happened at once. His dental office was taken by eminent domain by the city of Huntsville, and a parking lot was put there. The IRS charged him with owing $800,000 in back taxes and investigated him in a very harassing way before about 5 years. The FBI began an investigation of him. In a space of a year and a half, we moved from an all-white neighborhood in a palatial house back to an all-black neighborhood. And we went from a life of affluence to one where a family of five was living on my mother's $17,000 a year salary. So it was a dramatic change, and it became more painful as time went on.
Parents pass their hopes mm-hmm. and their dreams onto us, and for the children of agitators, people who risked it all, who put everything on the line, I'm wondering if you feel torn. Is there a need to follow in their footsteps, to be a social warrior yourself, or to run in the other direction and try to find security and comfort and maybe lift society or your family up in other ways, but to follow the path or choose another way?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. It's an extraordinary, complicated inheritance for children of agitators. I mean, I was writing this book and my children were near the age that I was when my parents were beginning to get involved in civil rights. I couldn't imagine taking my four-month-old baby to a civil rights protest. Wouldn't happen. And that was profound for me. That made me really perceive, you know, the sacrifices that all families ultimately make. I have the same kind of passion. All of my writing has ultimately something to do about American race relations and lifting up disenfranchised, impoverished people, mainly people of color. And that comes from my dad. And I have to say, personally, as a parent now, I'm less ambitious for myself. You know, I consciously say no to a lot of things to be home, to be with them, because I feel very conscious about the consequences of parents who are away. So I try to do my best, but I also try to conserve the home space and the family and make sure I raise two excellent, high-achieving African-American boys.
You're a law professor. Mm-hmm. You've done quite well for yourself. So for the next generation, for children who are raised in relative comfort, who don't face the same kind of social barriers, what do you pass on to them?
Well, I pass on to them what was passed on to me, which is, you know, one of the things that I'm so grateful to my dad that he gave me. I mean, he was broke when I was going off to college, but he gave me everything I needed to succeed, which is this idea that you are excellent, you can do anything you want that you put your mind to. There's no limits on you. As long as you're willing to, you know, have a dream and apply yourself with the discipline. And I write about this in the book. You know, my father was brilliant. He was a two-time valedictorian. When I came home with a test that had a 95 on it, he would say, "What happened to the other five?" Because he knew that I could do better. And so I would say to the next generation, this is what I'm say to my own children, that you can be anything, you can do anything, but it takes work.
Cheryl Cashin, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been good to talk to you. Cheryl Cashin is the author of The Agitator's Daughter, a memoir of four generations of one extraordinary African-American family.
Going to the grocery store is a pretty mundane activity, but the lists that we take with us can be fascinating pieces of anthropology. At least they are to a Los Angeles-based performance artist named Hilary Carlip. Day-to-Day's Alex Cohen has more.
Hilary Carlip found her first discarded grocery list when she was 15 years old.
I was in New York, and it was in front of the Red Apple Market. And it was so fascinating to me because, amongst other items, there were a lot of items, but there were Twizzlers, peanut brittle, and gum, and it was on the back of a dental appointment reminder card. And I just thought, okay, there's really something to this.
Since then, Carlip has collected thousands of these lists. She's found them all over the U.S., even in Europe.
Well, usually they're in a market, either in the little trash can behind the register or on the counter or just randomly in the market. I've found them on the streets. I've found them, you know, I've been known to do in back of a market a little dumpster diving if they're on top and they're clean and I have protective gloves.
Carlip goes to such great lengths because she believes you can tell a lot about a person just by looking at their shopping lists.
It's not only the items that are being bought, but it's also the handwriting, the kind of paper it's written on, the misspellings. I love the misspellings. One of my favorites is ant spray, A-U-N-T. Of course, for those pesky relatives.
These lists, Hilary Carlip says, are like little memoirs. And so she thought, why not bring them to life?
I at first did them on stage in performance pieces where I would literally get a shopping cart and just go across the stage as these different characters and recite what was on the list. And then it transformed over the years until finally, you know, it seemed like the right time for a book now because we're such a voyeuristic society right now. And everyone's like, the whole YouTube phenomenon is people are watching these glimpses into these strangers' lives. And to me, I thought people were really ready to get a glimpse into these people through their shopping lists.
For her book, A La Carte, The Secret Lives of Grocery Shoppers, Carla picked out 26 of her favorite shopping lists and created characters for them. She'd decide if the list belonged to a man or a woman, how old they were, what race they were, if they were gay or straight. And then she'd carefully scour the list looking for any clue into these people's lives.
You have to be a sleuth. You do. I found one recently that had tortillas, one PT. And I was like, what's that about? Like a pack? Is that maybe a K, not a T? Or a, can't be a pint? And so I kept looking at the list, and then I saw a WW yogurt. And I was like, okay, what is that? So the more I looked into it, I went, okay, it's got to be Weight Watchers yogurt. And in Weight Watchers, they count points. So it was 1 point tortillas.
That kind of item could belong to an overweight person desperately trying to become thin, or a skinny person who had once been heavier and now eats very particularly to stay trim. Hillary made these kinds of choices for her characters, and she gave them names. She also went shopping to find just the right clothes for these characters to wear. She went to thrift stores to make sure the outfits had been worn by real people many times before. And then she enlisted the help of a makeup artist friend.
It was really interesting that my makeup artist, Dominique Till, had a lot to contribute, because here I thought I had come up with these characters. And Maggie, for instance, I found her outfit and the wig, and she took a look at the list and what I was doing, and she went, you know what? I think she's totally freckled. And I was like, yeah, I could see that. And suddenly my entire body was covered with freckles, and it added so much.
Carlup, in full makeup and costume, went to various supermarkets that reflected each character, from local liquor stores to upscale groceries. And then she had her picture taken for each of these personalities. There's Bernadette, her cart full of hot dogs and ketchup standing in front of the racks of jumbo-size mustard bottles. Orlando, clutching his list, scrawled on court TV stationery in front of the cookie aisle. In addition to the photographs, Carlup also wrote short essays that give a glimpse into each of these characters' lives. For example, there's Graciela, whose list is scrawled in Spanish on plain pieces of paper and includes basic items like milk, sugar, ham, and potatoes.
Graciela never dreamed that La Casa Verde Pequeña, the restaurant her parents left to her and her two brothers, would go from barely getting by in a rundown neighborhood to becoming one of the trendiest restaurants in San Antonio, booked weeks in advance. Viva la gentrification and the gays!
The essay goes on to describe Graciela's success as an immigrant from Guadalajara. The items from her list make it into the essay, too.
Lately, Graciela has been exhausted. Between managing the restaurant, taking care of her homebound husband who has a chronic kidney condition, shopping for her granddaughter's quinceanera, and cooking her famous ham and cheese vegetable casserole for the event, it's surprising Graciela has any energy left to plan La Casa Verde Pequeña's float for the upcoming gay pride parade.
There's also Derek, the goth boy, whose list simply includes mousetraps, cheese, mouse. Dr. Bloom, whose list, written on Prozac stationery, leads to a story about a therapist inviting Gloria Steinem over for dinner. And the shortest and smallest list in the book, just Coors and Oreos, written on a matchbook, that inspires the story of Woody. For Woody's pages, Carlup composed an online dating profile.
Physical info. I am 5'7". I weigh 170 pounds. My hair is brown, long. Facial hair? Got a Fu Manchu. My eyes are brown, almost black, and sexy. My body style is closest to the guy who sings lead in Aerosmith, but his lips are bigger.
Hillary Carlup actually posted Woody's profile on the site eHarmony. He still gets email queries to this day. Woody and the other characters in her book, A La Carte, have been such a success, Hillary Carlup is now in talks to turn her shopping list shtick into a series for television. Alex Cohen, NPR News.
You can see some of the shopping lists and the characters that Hillary Carlup has turned them into at our blog. That's npr.org/daydreaming. While you're there, why don't you submit a shopping list of your own, because Hillary's agreed to create a character from one of your shopping lists, and we'll feature that later on the blog. Again, npr.org/daydreaming.
I am Netta Ulaby, host of NPR's podcast, Book Tour. Few books this year have received more outstanding reviews than a first novel called The Story of Edgar Sawtelle. Author David Robleski reads from his book about a child who cannot speak and the dog who becomes his protector.
Almandine began to pant. She shifted her weight from one hip to the other. She finally understood. The thing that was going to happen was that her time for training was over. And now, at last, she had a job to do.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please visit npr.org/booktour.
Put together the wartime Nazi occupation of an island off the British coast and an improbable recipe for pie, and you have the ingredients for a delightful novel by Marianne Schaefer. The book, The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, was written as a series of letters. The novel itself is a love letter to writing and to books. It's 1946. World War II is finally over. The main character, Juliet Ashton, lives in bombed-out London. She's a former newspaper columnist who has one moderately successful book to her credit. She's looking for something to write about for her second book when she gets a letter from Guernsey. Her subject has found her. Over time, she becomes intimately bound up in the islanders' lives through her correspondence with them. First-time novelist Marianne Schaefer wrote the book late in life after a long career as a librarian. Her niece, Annie Barrows, already a published author, helped with the final editing. Annie Barrows, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us how you got involved in this book.
When Marianne sold the book, there was a lot of work to be done for publication, and it was right about at that point that Marianne's health began to fail, and she asked me to finish the book for her. She died in February, which is heartbreaking to me, although I do keep looking over my shoulder because I think she must be here somewhere watching everybody enjoy her book.
What inspired her to write the book?
Well, she went to Guernsey in 1976, sort of on a whim. And she flew into Guernsey, and a terrible fog enveloped the island, and the plane service and the ferry service were cut off, and she was stuck for 72 hours. She says she spent the entire time in the men's room under the hand dryer, because the hand dryer in the women's room was broken, trying to keep herself warm and reading every book in the Guernsey Airport bookstore. And that was where she learned of the occupation of Guernsey during the Second World War. And those stories that she read stuck with her for over 20 years. And when her writing group finally forced her to sit down and begin writing a novel, the story of Guernsey's occupation was what came to her.
That's one of the most remarkable parts of this book. I knew nothing about the Nazi occupation of Guernsey. Let's start out setting a little time and place. I'd like you to read one of the letters to Juliet, the main character. Let's start with page 105.
Okay. Hitler was fanatic about fortifying these islands. England was never to get them back. His generals called it island madness. He ordered large gun emplacements, anti-tank walls on the beaches, hundreds of bunkers and batteries, arms and bomb depots, miles and miles of underground tunnels, a huge underground hospital, and a railroad to cross the island to carry materials. The coastal fortifications were absurd. The Channel Islands were better fortified than the Atlantic Wall built against an Allied invasion. The installations jutted out over every bay. The Third Reich was to last 1,000 years in concrete.
Now, how does the Literary Society come to be named?
Well, a group of neighbors and friends on the island of Guernsey had a secret roast pig dinner one night. It was illegal to keep a pig on the island. The German authorities wanted all the pigs for themselves. So the group of friends had a secret dinner, and they stayed so late over their tasty meal that they were breaking curfew. They decided to go home anyway, and just as they hit the road, the German patrol officers leaped out of the bushes and told them they were under arrest. One of their members managed to summon up enough courage to say, "Oh, we're so terribly sorry. We were just having a meeting of the Guernsey Literary Society, and we got so excited about discussing our book that we lost all track of the time. Would you care to come to our next meeting? And the patrol officer's heart is softened, and he says, all right, I won't arrest you, and yes, I would like to come to your next meeting, and lets them all go. Well, of course, then they have to create the Guernsey Literary Society just in case the officer does show up, and that was the beginning of the club.
The people that Juliet encounters through her correspondence, they all connect. It all revolves around one woman, and that's Elizabeth. She's missing at the center of this story because she's not on the island. And what does Juliet learn about her?
Well, Elizabeth is brave and funny and determined to save all of her friends from trouble. And she does that over and over again. She's the one that creates the literary society. She's the one that saves another character, John Booker, because he's half Jewish, but she convinces him that he can't tell anybody that. She over and over again is the courageous one whom everybody turns to in their trouble.
One of the great themes of this book is these islanders, some of them taciturn, you know, farmers, are changed by reading. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the book does explore an idea that both Marianne and I hold very dear, which is that reading really can save your life. And this group of farmers and fishermen, when they begin to read, they discover that books are a place to go, a place of refuge, that when they talk about books, when they read books, when they feel deeply about what they're reading, they can forget what's going on outside the doors. They can forget that they live in an occupied territory, that the people who are running the island are brutal. They can forget all the sorrows that they're experiencing in their daily life. And they become the kind of reader that we all want to be, devoted and passionate and in love with literature.
Did your aunt impart that kind of love of literature to you?
Yes, my aunt is one of the two greatest readers I've ever encountered. The other one is my mother. Every time I picture Marianne, I picture her, as I always saw her throughout my entire childhood, sitting at her dining room table with a cup of cold coffee by her side and a stack of books next to her, all of them with those plastic covers that come on library books. And she would read one, read it through, put it aside, and read another. You know, she was a great, great reader.
Annie Barrows is the co-author of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. She completed the book after her aunt, Marianne Schaefer, died.
Being a field goal kicker in the NFL is one of the last great athletic fantasies many men have. As most of us grow up, we have to accept that we're not large, strong, or let's face it, talented enough to be a running back, linebacker, or quarterback. But running out onto the field a few times a game, swinging your leg, knocking a football through a big fat hole in the goalpost, that seems temptingly easy, even if you consider that a bunch of 300 pounders are just a few feet over the line running full speed to try and squash you. Stefan Fatsis, a commentator for NPR's weekday edition, sometimes known as All Things Considered, persuaded Pro Football's Denver Broncos to let him try. He got to wear number 9, however briefly, and write a new book, A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. Stefan Fatsis joins us. We're on the field of Georgetown University.
Yes, we are, where I have practiced once upon a time.
And in fact, we're going to talk to your coach, Paul Woodside, who's just down there. Thanks so much for being with us.
It is my pleasure, Scott.
How did you ever persuade the Denver Broncos to say yes?
You know, I asked. They were the 20th or so team that I asked, but I asked, and they said yes. The owner, Pat Bowlen, was a good source of mine when I covered the business of sports for the Wall Street Journal, and I just called him up one day and said, I have this idea to sort of do a modern George Plimpton and run out.
The book Paper Lion, where he played quarterback for about 2 minutes.
In the early 1960s. Yeah. And he thought about it for 1 second and said, you know, I wouldn't be averse to that.
Now, at least in your literary account, you got to be pretty good.
Compared to
certainly compared to me. What of all the examples to choose, but yes, right.
But I worked hard. I spent a year with a personal trainer, gaining weight, getting into shape. I put on about a dozen pounds. And then I found Paul Woodside, a kicking coach nearby in Northern Virginia. And Paul drilled me for 4 or 5 months, and he taught me how to kick. And he taught me the emotional part of kicking, too. But, yeah, I by the end, I was kicking 35- and 40-yard field goals, which I think is pretty good. Because if you stand on a football field, 40 yards away from the goalposts, yeah, you will realize just how far that is.
You really do begin to get glimpses of the players as people, as opposed to the performers that you see on screen. On the one hand, they all have big cars and they all have personal managers, but they're not all rich, are they?
No, they're not, particularly the guys that are going through camp right now who don't have a real shot of making the league. The average career of an NFL player who finally does make a team is 3 years. But in most of these camps, when I was in Denver, about 100 players cycled through camp, and only 60 of them made the roster. That's a pretty high burn rate. And many of these kids come back, because a lot of them are kids just out of college. They'll come back year after year after year until the NFL doesn't want them anymore. And in the course of those 3 or 4 years that they spend trying to make the league, they're not going to take other jobs. And off-season pay in the NFL, you get a little bonus if you're lucky, 20, 30 grand, $400 a week during spring workouts, $1,000 a week at the beginning of training camp, and a little bit more during the preseason. Not much.
The public sees football players for, well, now with all the commercials, let's say 3 to 4 hours on game day, Sunday. But that's really only a small percentage of what they do for a living.
Yeah.
Because it's a 7-day-a-week job.
Right.
You get a real clear sense in this book that a lot of that is drudgery.
One player described it to me as this way, and I think this is one of my favorite quotations from the book. This is a wide receiver named Charlie Adams. And he said to me, you know, you're just seeing the worst part, meaning training camp. And then he paused and he said, you know, although the season kind of sucks too.
Yes.
And the message was that we love playing. Sunday is terrific. Sunday is the greatest. But it's Wednesday and Thursday, and the routine and the monotony and the emotional pressure and the psychological pressure and the insecurity. I mean, the NFL is nothing if not a culture of insecurity. There are no guaranteed contracts, unlike in all of our other professional sports.
I wonder if doing this gave you any new thoughts or refined any thoughts you had on the difference between playing and doing.
You know, the last time I did this, play and do, was to write about Scrabble, and all in your head. If I had the mental capacity to digest thousands of words, I could be a pretty good player. If I could understand the geometry of the board and the strategy involved in this game, I could be okay. In this, there are externalities. You know, my body could only do so much. You know, the burden of my genetic makeup, my age, my build, the number of fast twitch muscle fibers I was born with, those were the real limitations. If I had started when I was 16, I don't know. But at 43, I was pretty happy to get a few balls up in the air from 40 yards away and have them go between those uprights. And when I did that, it was just pure joy, pure elation, because I did feel like I understood a little bit better what they experienced. I really understood it when I had to kick under pressure during training camp.
Because you eventually did have to kick under pressure during training.
I did.
You didn't get into an actual game, but you got into...
Yeah, the NFL wouldn't let me play in an actual game, but Mike Shanahan, the head coach, called me out a couple times. And the first time he called me out, he said, there's a lot of pressure put on kickers in the NFL. We're going to put some pressure on Stefan now. And when I was called out there, I never felt any pressure like that in my life.
Yeah.
I forgot my entire routine. I forgot how to be calm. I forgot how to be powerful. I forgot how to attack the ball. And I choked. There were more than 1,000 fans there that day, 90 players, the coaches. And my first kick was one of the worst kicks I'd ever made to that point. It went under the crossbar from 30 yards. And from 30 yards, I was pretty good. It helped bond me to the players, though, because they all, after they were done, you know, threatening to tie me to the goalposts, they all came up to me and said, now you get it. That's what it's about. And I think that made me part of the team.
I'm not sure I've confessed this before, but sometimes when I'm having problems falling asleep, I become the quarterback of the Chicago Bears in the Super Bowl. And I'm usually able to run 2 or 3 plays before I fall asleep. I'm able to get the first down. Has this affected your dreams?
I never dreamt that I was kicking the winning field goal in the Super Bowl. Not at night, anyway. I had the opportunity to actually perform it. It wasn't just a dream for me. I was certainly never a real NFL player, but when I ran onto the field dressed in a Denver Broncos uniform before preseason games, I felt like one.
You still have your uniform.
You bet. When I'm done showing it off, it's going to be framed.
Stefan Fatsis, his new book is A Few Seconds of Panic, a 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. And let's tell people that special added value on our website, if they're going to see you and your coach, Paul Woodside, try and teach us how to, when I say us, I guess I mean me, how to kick a football.
Yes, we are going to teach you how to kick a football, Scott. I don't know whether we'll be successful or not, but we're going to find out.
Yeah. You good to go?
Yeah, sure.
Let me introduce you to the ball.
Okay.
Okay, but I need you to keep your toe down. Keep your toe down.
Okay, my left toe, right?
Your right toe.
Right toe down,
it's
okay.
It's going to be your right toe.
Uh-huh.
Bring your heel back to your butt. Bring your heel back to your butt.
Oh, there you go. Leg to butt. Leg to butt.
And then what?
Just come through and hit that. Perfect. Set.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.